We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. As always, so much to talk about over the next hour, including that new study that suggests eating red meat isn't that bad for us, but not everyone agrees. We'll also talk about how eating nuts can help us control our weight gain. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, so we'll get an update on breast cancer screening and treatments. Plus, we'll talk about heart disease in women, stents, and fish oil supplements. That's all coming up. But first, let's start today's show the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchhold. Dr. Buchhold is a SLU care general internist with SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchhold, thanks for joining us again.
Glad to be here.
We'll get your thoughts on that new controversial red meat study in a minute. But first, wanted to ask you about another diet study. This one finds Americans aren't changing their eating habits much, despite what we know.
A new study on America's eating habits shows very little improvement over the past 16 years. The data from government health surveys dating to 1999 involving nearly 44,000 adults show U.S. adults did cut down some on added sugars and ate more whole grains. But saturated fat intake increased to almost 12% of total calories. The study authors say Americans still eat too many sweetened foods and artery-clogging fats. Jim Shenevy, CBS News.
So I guess the big question here is, what makes a good diet?
That's a great question. The short answer is I don't think there's any real hard evidence of what makes a good or bad diet. You know, there's always new diets are out there. You know, a bunch of residents I work with are into the keto diet, and you know, who knows whether there's a true benefit of that or not. And just as a background, dietary studies are just really difficult to do and to get really clear answers about what's good and what's not is just incredibly hard to tease out. And I think that's why we always have all these, you know, articles, eggs are good for you, then they're bad for you, then they're good for you again, et cetera, et cetera. I think generally, and what I tell my patients is, you know, the less processing that's done to your food, the better. So, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, simply prepared, are probably the main, should be the mainstay of your diet. Leaner meats, so fish and chicken and turkey, are probably better than red meat such as pork or beef. And certainly, you know, lowest on that food chain in terms of protein is, you know, processed meats like bacon is as delicious as it is and other types of prepared meals. You know, a lot of places, the availability of fresh produce, particularly, you know, in certain areas of the St. Louis, is hard. And so people's options for eating or to buy inexpensive food tend to be these higher processed foods that have a lot of fat and oil in them. And that's really kind of a product of what's available and what's affordable to pay for. And that certainly is a huge issue as well. But I always tell my patients, when you go to the store, if you just kind of visualize your typical grocery store, I just say try to stay on the outside. You know, so you go in, usually on one side is the produce section, you know, spend most of your time there, and then you'll go to the meat section and again look for leaner meats. Sometimes with frozen vegetables, they're flash frozen in the fields, so those are actually as good as fresh produce and can be cheaper and store a little bit longer. But just pay attention to things that are processed or have sauces added, and those tend to have higher amounts of sodium. And then in the middle of the store is where the chips are, which, you know, again, are delicious, but you need to be taken in moderation, and, you know, all the canned and processed foods, and those should be minimized as much as possible.
So let's talk about this new controversial study that just came out this past week about red meat consumption. CBS News medical contributor Dr. Tara Narula tells us about it.
The studies, published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, conclude there's little to no effects from eating meat on illnesses like heart disease, cancer, or diabetes. The controversial study also recommends consumers who eat as much as 4 servings a week can continue to do so. Those results run counter to long-established health guidelines to reduce consumption of red and processed meats because of their links to cancer and poor cardiovascular health. The nonprofit Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine called the results misrepresentations and said that there's abundant evidence linking red and processed meat to heart disease and increased risk of premature death, adding the findings are a major disservice to public health and wants the medical journal to issue a public retraction.
Again, this is CBS News medical contributor Dr. Tara Narula.
These are not official guidelines, nor are they endorsed by any government or health body. In fact, hundreds of leading doctors, scientists, and nutritionists are calling the publication reckless, irresponsible, and inaccurate. The research from these very studies showed significant decreases in cardiovascular disease, cancer mortality, and diabetes with lower meat consumption. Bottom line, this should not change current recs to eat a healthy, balanced pattern of food that's limited in red and processed meat.
So, Dr. Buchholz, what's your take on all of this?
There's a lot to unpack here. This is a controversial study. What they did, which is a bit different than everything else, is just kind of do a careful look at what information is out there and applied some pretty heavy rigor to that, which is not common. Nutritional studies and linking them to any kind of health outcome are just so hard to do. To do them well takes time, and it costs a lot of money. And in this day and age, it's just difficult to do. And so to get to answer these questions, we scientists will, for lack of a better term, take shortcuts, just try to do a more shallower analysis of data that's already there, and that's subject to what we call bias. You know, there's just a chance that the information may not be the information. You're not sure really what the results are. So that's why you get all these studies that say, you know, eggs are good for you, eggs are bad for you, and people are left going, what the heck is going on? My take from this and reading this is really they are just saying there's no evidence that red meat causes bad long-term health outcomes that they can find. And that doesn't mean that they do or don't. It just means that these pieces of evidence aren't out there. There's no evidence that shows a parachute is helpful when you jump out of an airplane, but most people would want to jump out of an airplane with a parachute. I know I would. And so it's the old mantra of an absence of evidence doesn't mean there's an evidence of absence. And that's something even doctors have a hard time thinking about. So this is something where all humans have a hard time getting a good understanding of, and this is another perfect example. They're just saying we can't find the evidence for this and making big, big recommendations that affect people's life is not warranted based on this panel's kind of review of that literature.
So your advice is stay the course?
I think so. I mean, again, to me, in my own personal diet, who I'm a guy that loves steak and I love bacon, and I'm not sure the long-term health consequences, and I'm just kind of making the decision for myself. This is not something I want to eat every day. You know, I think diversity in your diet is probably a good thing. So with my steak or bacon with breakfast I'll have once a week, I'll also have, you know, granola or fruit or cereal or something else. And same thing with my dinners. Instead of ground beef every night, I'll try to put in fish or chicken and other poultry and such and just have that diversity. I think that is probably the key. But again, no evidence.
We're talking with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchholz. He's a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, it's one of the biggest dangers for aging adults, and that's falling.
When it comes to falls, for an aging adult, there's no such thing as routine. Kathleen Cameron at the National Council on Aging.
About 1 in 4 older adults will fall every year, and about 20% of those who fall will experience a traumatic injury like a broken bone or a traumatic brain injury.
Cameron says the key is to work on balance and strength training starting around age 65, before falls typically become much of a concern. And many senior citizen centers have classes and other resources aimed at improving balance and keeping people from suffering a fall-related injury.
How big of a deal is falling in the elderly?
It's a huge deal. You know, first and foremost is the reasons why people, particularly as they get older, fall, and that more likely than not suggests or is kind of a sign of other kind of chronic medical conditions. And as we age, we lose our muscle mass anyway. And so falls really are kind of a symptom or a sign of kind of that critical loss of muscle mass. And this concept we talk a lot about called frailty that really kind of puts you at risk for worsened health outcomes. And once a fall occurs, particularly if you break a bone, and most commonly people will break their hip, and that requires pretty urgent repair, because if that doesn't get repaired, afterwards you're just never able to walk properly ever again. And so not only does the fall have a big issue, you break a big bone, the surgery for that is pretty intense, and the recovery from that is pretty intense, and the health risks that come with breaking a large bone, most commonly a blood clot, all that just kind of becomes exponential. It's a big, big deal, and something when you take care of patients in the hospital, we see all the time. And you have to be very, very aggressive in taking care of this, and it still could portend a bad outcome in the long term.
Any tips for listeners on how to strengthen themselves against falling?
Absolutely. Everybody, an important thing throughout your life is resistance training. So this is exercise done against weight, where your muscles are pushing against something or pulling against something. So, walking, running, aerobic activity is wonderful and an important part of our physical fitness, but some degree of resistance training, either using light weights, rubber bands, some other activity where you do those motions, helps keep up your muscle strength. It helps with your balance and certainly helps with falls. My parents will probably get mad at me for saying this, but as I tell them, it's also helpful to have a little bit of extra weight as you get older. So, at some point as we age, the mantra of you've got to lose weight turns into, well, maybe it's okay to have those few extra pounds on. It ironically enough, acts as a little bit of a buffer were you to fall. And so I'm sorry, Mom and Dad, for that, but I tell them that all the time.
Fall has just begun, so I guess colds and flus are out there. Dr. Buchholz, what do you think about this?
If you're hoping to ward off the flu with hand sanitizer, think again. According to researchers in Japan, in order to kill the flu virus with hand sanitizer, you'd have to rub your hands with the stuff for 4 solid minutes. In lab testing, the influenza A virus remained infectious when exposed to ethanol-based sanitizer for a full 2 minutes. It took twice that to completely deactivate it. Jim Shenevy, CBS News.
So is soap still the best choice?
I always felt that way and always feel that way. Now, granted, I'm not always using that myself. I think the alcohol sanitation really came in vogue and is still used, and we use it in our hospital, and every hospital has it, is because that's probably better than not washing hands at all, which happens kind of still at an alarming rate in healthcare and outside of healthcare. And so, it's probably better than nothing. But with certain infections that we see in the hospital, soap and water is still preferable. I think the way soap works chemically probably has more of an effect of breaking up the fats that encase most bacteria and viruses, and some of the proteins as well, better than alcohol. That does make some sense. I find it interesting.
Any other tips?
Get your flu shot. So I got mine on Tuesday, and other than getting the needle stick, it felt fine. And I think that's really, really important, not just for you individually, but there's a concept called herd immunity, where the more people that are vaccinated, it tends to reduce the spread amongst the herd, so to speak, which is us, when we're all confined in close environments in the winter when it's cold outside. So not only is it good for you, it's good for your family and good for your colleagues at work or in any other public place you tend to be at in the winter.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Always glad to be here.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU Care General Internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll talk about how to treat heart disease risk in women. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study from the United Kingdom documents a heart attack gender gap.
The British Heart Foundation reports an estimated 2 women a day here are dying unnecessarily from heart attacks because they don't receive the same treatment as men. Among other things, the study found female heart attack patients are 50% more likely than men to receive an incorrect diagnosis. Since U.S. studies have shown fewer American women than men survive a first heart attack, all indications are that that gender gap crosses national boundaries. Vicky Barker, CBS News.
Joining us now to talk about that is Dr. Stephanie White. Dr. White is a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. White, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us more about this study. What did this study find?
It looks as if, you know, maybe it's less about a gender gap in actual prevalence of disease, but more a miss on our end of treating females appropriately. So, for instance, what we're finding is that once we diagnose a heart attack in a patient, we're finding that maybe some of the MIs were preventable in some of the females because, you know, some of them aren't getting treated upstream of their heart attack for their cholesterol, which was high. And so maybe there was an opportunity for us to prevent some heart attacks downstream.
You mentioned MIs. What are MIs?
Myocardial infarction, so heart attacks. So, you know, things that increase our risk for heart attacks are going to be high blood pressure, high cholesterol, smoking, you know, and family history. And if we're not regularly screening our patients for these diseases, then oftentimes we miss the opportunity to prevent heart attacks downstream.
So is this more about the gender gap in treating risk factors or in treating heart attack symptoms?
I think it may be less about symptoms and more about identifying patients who may be at risk for having a heart attack and then treating them to help prevent. So, you know, if you look also, this study came out of the UK. So if you look at incidence of heart attacks here in the United States, it's about equal between men and women. But some of the retrospective data are showing that even after we have diagnosed heart attacks in these patients, it looks as if maybe some of them might have been preventable and maybe more of them preventable in women than men because we didn't identify patients before their heart attack, you know, as at risk. I know that's kind of confusing, but, you know, so it might not necessarily be that we're missing the actual heart attack, but we're missing the opportunity before the heart attack in order to prevent it.
Got it. So this happens way upstream before it all comes downstream.
Right. This happens way before. Now, if you look at maybe in the early 90s, whenever we were missing heart attacks in women and misdiagnosing them and they were doing poor, we've had this big push from the American Heart Association and the American College of Cardiology that has really pushed here in the United States that women can have different symptoms than men. And I think we've gotten so much better at identifying that women may present differently from men. And so where we still have a way to make up the difference is making sure that everybody gets treated equally and appropriately.
So talk to me about the risk factors that we can control. What could we be doing?
Right. So there is just what I tell my patients is to know your number. So know what your blood pressure is, know what your cholesterol is. And if it's high based on the guidelines, then there's either medication to treat that or there's some diet and lifestyle modification that you can do in order to lower it. You know, we recommend in general a blood pressure under 140 over 90. There are some new data to suggest maybe we can be a little more aggressive in that area. That's kind of up to, you know, patients and their physicians to kind of talk about. And then knowing what your cholesterol is and then deciding if that patient would be appropriately treated with a cholesterol medicine based on age and other risk factors. So we've got hypertension, high cholesterol, does the patient smoke? That is probably the biggest opportunity we have for prevention is to have, you know, patients try to quit smoking because that can make the biggest impact on long-term mortality is smoking cessation. And then there are patients that just are born with the genes that they're born with that, you know, their family history, their father or mother had a heart attack early in life. You know, there's not a lot we can do about that, but we can be more aggressive about prevention on those patients. And then, you know, other things that we can do from a diet and lifestyle standpoint would be increasing our daily activity. The American College of Cardiology recommends 150 minutes a week of aerobic activity. It can be divided however patients can get that in. And then we also recommend as close to a plant-based diet as possible. That's what I recommend to my patients. Technically, we recommend a Mediterranean diet, which is high fruits and vegetables, grains, not a lot of red meat, and some fish.
We are talking with Dr. Stephanie White. She's a cardiologist at SSM Health Medical Group. Dr. White, earlier this week, we heard that Bernie Sanders, after having some chest discomfort, ended up going to the hospital and had to have two stents put in. How common are stents these days?
I would say it's pretty common for us to identify patients that need stents. You know, oftentimes we'll have patients that have, you know, pretty typical chest pain, and they'll have a stress test, which will be abnormal. And then, you know, oftentimes if, you know, they don't have severe disease in many of their heart vessels, then we can get by with helping their symptoms with stents. I would say stents are more common these days than bypass surgery, just because technology has gotten so much better. So it is pretty common. I would say maybe overall incidence of heart attacks has gone down, but we still do regularly see patients getting stents.
What's the recovery process like for someone who gets a stent?
So it really depends on the procedure the patient has. Sometimes we are able to go through the wrist versus the artery in the leg. But, you know, either way, patients do really well after the procedure, especially in comparison to bypass, when patients may be in the hospital for a week or two or three, depending on how they do. Stents, patients technically get to go home much sooner. They'll go home usually within 24, 48 hours of the stent, and then they can usually return to normal activity probably within a week.
Once a patient gets a stent, do they have an increased chance for heart problems down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just the idea of once you're diagnosed with heart disease, your likelihood of having more problems with your heart down the road is just by sheer percentages higher. Oftentimes, you know, if you do address what patients' risks are, you can decrease the risk of having multiple events, and sometimes patients don't have any more. But it really depends on, you know, how well patients' risk factors are controlled and, you know, how well they're doing with their medicine, and there's many issues that go into that. It's hard to estimate, actually.
Dr. White, one more thing I wanted to ask you about. A new study this past week from Harvard found fish oil supplements may do your heart good. It seems that this study found that people who took a fish oil supplement on a daily basis had an 8% drop in their risk for heart attack or death due to coronary heart disease. Dr. White, what do you tell your patients about fish oil supplements?
Well, up until now, in reviewing this study, you know, before this, you know, we didn't have good evidence to suggest that fish oil directly reduce people's risk of heart attack. But now with this showing that patients may have an 8% reduced risk of having a heart attack, it looks like it would be appropriate for patients to increase their fish oil supplements in their diet in order to prevent it. You know, there's not a lot of side effects from the medication. You know, it's probably not very expensive like most prescription drugs. So, you know, if it's low risk and good benefit, I'll probably start recommending more fish oil other than patients that I technically would just, you know, usually recommend for high triglycerides. But it looks like we can expand that to more patients now.
Dr. White, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate your help.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Stephanie White is a cardiologist with the SSM Health Medical Group. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Coming up next, we'll talk about the latest in research, screening, and treatment of this disease. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Did you know approximately 1 in 8 women born today in the United States will get breast cancer? According to the CDC, not counting some kinds of skin cancer, breast cancer in the United States is the most common cancer in women, no matter your race or ethnicity. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Here to talk with us about that and the latest in research, screening, and treatment is Dr. Teresa Schwartz, Dr. Schwartz is a slew care breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Schwartz, thanks for joining us again.
Yes, thanks, Fred.
I wanted to start out by asking you about a new study that finds exercise really does do a lot to fight breast cancer.
New research shows even moderate exercise can help prevent and slow the growth of breast tumors. Dr. Nigel Brockton is with the American Institute for Cancer Research, which funded the study.
Half an hour a day of walking is about how much these women were doing. You compare that to the control group who were sedentary, which is 23 minutes of activity per week.
The active women also added strength training to their routines. The exercise appeared to impact tumor behavior in less than a month. Wendy Gillette, CBS News.
Dr. Schwartz, what are your thoughts about exercise preventing breast cancer?
Yeah, this is one of several studies that have been coming out over recent years talking about the importance of regular exercise and maintaining a more normal body weight. The importance of having more body muscle than body fat ends up decreasing your risk of a breast cancer recurrence or breast cancer development. And part of having more muscle than fat is having a good, reasonable exercise regimen that you can stick with regularly. So this additional research is just adding credence to the idea that regular exercise with either walking and it most notably weightlifting would be helpful in the long run to reduce risk of recurrence.
Another new report just out finds that the breast cancer mortality rate is falling.
While more women are being diagnosed with breast cancer, fewer women are dying from it. Carol DeSantis is an epidemiologist with the American Cancer Society.
The decline in breast cancer death rates really reflects the improvements in breast cancer treatment over the past several decades, as well as earlier diagnosis.
Black women are 40% more likely to die from breast cancer than white women, but DeSantis says the decline in death cancer rates is faster in black women and has slowed in white women. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Why do you think the mortality rate is falling?
There's a lot of things that go into our breast cancer mortality rates, and it's very exciting to see how far those rates have dropped just in the last 20 years. And most of it we can contribute to a combination of better screening and early detection, as well as more development of our more targeted therapies that can really go after exactly what is making a tumor grow and be able to kill it more effectively. So I think it's a combination of early detection and improving our treatment regimens.
Tell me some more, Dr. Schwartz, about improved treatments for breast cancer.
Most of the big improvements that have affected mortality have had to do with the development of more targeted chemotherapy regimens. Now we have the ability to look at several different genes inside a breast cancer tumor and be able to tell what is really driving that tumor to grow. And then drugs have been created to go after those targets. So being able to more appropriately treat each individual cancer and what's making that cancer tick has created dramatic improvements in how women have done with this disease. So it's all of the basic science research and translating that into clinical care that's making a large difference.
This past week, a famous singer's father announced that he has breast cancer.
Beyoncé's dad is talking about the life-threatening diagnosis he received after he noticed a dot of blood on his T-shirt.
I immediately went to my doctor. I got a mammogram, and then it was very clear that I had breast cancer.
Matthew Knowles tells ABC's Good Morning America.
From a man's perspective, I'm thinking, why me?
He says it's changed his life.
I have that BRCA2 that's mutated, which means I have four things to be concerned about. Prostate cancer, pancreatic cancer, melanoma, and breast cancer.
Knowles underwent surgery in July. Deborah Rodriguez, CBS News.
Dr. Schwartz, tell us more about men and breast cancer.
Men developing breast cancer is very uncommon, but it's not impossible. So about 1% of all of our breast cancer diagnoses in the United States are actually in men. So this is not a women-only disease.
What should men be looking out for?
The same symptoms that Beyonce's father noticed. Men are not going to be getting screening mammograms. They aren't going to be getting breast ultrasounds or MRIs. So it really is going to be paying attention to your own clinical exam, whether it's nipple discharge that really should never be apparent, especially if it's bloody, or if there's a breast mass or skin changes or any change in the chest wall that's different from your previous appearance. Those are the symptoms that should prompt immediate attention.
We're talking with Dr. Teresa Schwartz. She's a slew care breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Dr. Schwartz, so I wanted to ask you some questions about breast cancer awareness, beginning with, what's the message you want women to have these days?
I think the message in terms of screening has been a little bit difficult because we have so many different governing boards that decide when women should get screening mammograms. But in my opinion, as well as the opinion of our breast surgeon societies, as well as our breast imaging societies, is that all women starting at age 40 should receive a mammogram every year while they are healthy. So there should be no question starting at age 40, as long as you are asymptomatic, obtaining a screening mammogram. Anybody else who has an abnormality, whether it's on exam on yourself or exam by a physician, that should definitely warrant further workup as well. But it's more paying attention to any changes in your own exam or anything that your physician would find and making sure those are worked up appropriately.
What are some other things women can do to try and prevent breast cancer?
I think there's a lot that we can do in terms of making sure you live an overall healthy lifestyle. The limits on alcohol have been well established. For women, the recommendations are to have, on average, less than one alcoholic drink per week to keep your risk of breast cancer as low as possible. There is no safe level of tobacco, so that should be avoided at all costs. And as we discussed earlier, making sure you have a healthy exercise regimen and a healthy diet to keep your body fat as low as would be healthy for you. And something else that's important, this being October, there's going to be plenty of family events with holidays upcoming over the next few months. And this is a great time to be able to talk to your entire family that you don't see on a regular basis to get a good understanding of what your family history entails. We don't tend to talk about illnesses at family events. And I think cancer is one thing that tends to be not discussed publicly, but it does help each individual patient a lot to know what their real family history consists of and be able to pass that along to their physicians.
Dr. Schwartz, what are some of the risk factors for breast cancer?
The main risk factors for breast cancer development are being female and getting older. And those are two risk factors we can't modify. However, there are other risk factors that are very important to talk about with your physician. One of those being supplemental estrogen use, family history of any cancers, and that's not just breast cancer, but family history of any type of malignancy, as well as any previous breast procedures or breast abnormal mammograms that you've had in the past. Those all contribute to a woman's risk for breast cancer development.
It seems to me like breast cancer used to be synonymous with a death sentence for women at some point. That's not the case anymore.
That is not the case anymore. In fact, the vast, vast majority survive this disease. And even though we have 300,000 new breast cancer diagnoses a year, we still do have women who die of this disease. So there's a lot of work to be done, but we have made strides compared to where this care of breast cancer used to be, even as recently as 40 years ago.
Dr. Schwartz, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Fred.
Dr. Teresa Schwartz is a SLU care breast surgeon at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up, we'll find out how just a handful of nuts may help keep us from putting on the pounds. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study suggests if we eat more nuts, we might be able to keep off those extra pounds. Here to talk with us about that is Jessica Stafford. Jessica is a registered dietitian with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital, Lake St. Louis. Jessica, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about this study. What did it find?
I am so excited about this study. When it comes to nutrition research, as registered dietitians, we like big studies that take place over a number of years. And at the Harvard School of Public Health, they did a very large study. They looked at three different groups. They looked at over 27,000 men enrolled in the health professional follow-up study from 1986 to 2010. They also looked at over 61,000 women in the nurses' health study, and they also looked at 55,000 women in the nurses' study part two. And what they found is that those who eat nuts on a regular basis gain less weight each year than those that don't.
How much of a difference did it make?
So those that consume 28 grams or 1 ounce of nuts a day were able to starve off between 0.41 to 0.7 kilograms of weight in a 4-year period. So that's about over a pound a year that they did not gain.
And you said 1 ounce of nuts a day. How much would you consider to be an ounce?
An ounce is about 1/4 cup of nuts. 1/4 cup of nuts, it fits nicely in the palm of your hand so that you can still close your hand.
What kind of nuts? Does it make a difference what kind we eat?
No, nuts are wonderful. There's so many different types of nuts, and the study found that it didn't really matter which type of nut you ate. You still did not see that weight gain. I will add that of all the nuts, the walnut is kind of the king of nuts. It is the highest in omega-3 fatty acids, and those that were eating walnuts every day, their percentage of weight that they didn't gain was just slightly higher. So again, walnuts are kind of like the king of nuts. They're higher in the omega-3s, and those that ate them every day did not gain as much weight.
What's the thinking behind this? Why are nuts so good for us at maybe helping us lose weight or not gain as much weight?
Nuts are great because they taste good, they're convenient, and they can be enjoyed on all types of diets, from the keto diet to a vegan diet. Nuts are high in fiber, protein, heart-healthy fat, and they're full of antioxidants and vitamins and minerals.
And I guess part of the thinking here is that the more nuts you eat, the less bad stuff you'll eat, correct?
Absolutely. That's what they found. If you are eating nuts, you're not eating the highly processed snack foods. Nuts are, again, they're high in fiber, they're high in protein, they're high in the unsaturated fats. And what that means is when you eat them, you're forced to eat them a little bit slower because they take longer to chew, and they take longer to digest because they are packed with all of those nutrients.
Aren't they also full of calories, though? Wouldn't that be a problem?
Yes. Nuts are high in calories. 1/4 cup of nuts is going to have about 173 calories, which it is a big number, but again, the nuts have so many other benefits like the fiber, the protein, the vitamins and minerals. So you're better off having a handful of nuts as a snack as opposed to a handful of cheese puffs.
We're talking with Jessica Stafford. She's a registered dietitian with SSM Health, St. Joseph Hospital, Lake St. Louis. Jessica, nuts have also been linked to a lower risk of heart disease and diabetes, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Eating nuts on a regular basis, it is going to protect you from heart disease, heart attack, stroke. It's going to reduce your risk of diabetes, cancer, and inflammation. Nuts, they may help lower your cholesterol, so that's why they have the heart benefit. They're also going to help lower your triglycerides, which is a benefit to both your heart and to diabetes.
Any other suggestions for things we should eat or do to try and ward off the oncoming weight gain as we get older?
Including nuts is an excellent choice. In addition to eating nuts, I encourage you to eat other whole foods, including fruits, vegetables, whole grains like whole wheat bread. If you're reaching for a snack food, you could always have popcorn. Popcorn is a whole grain. Eating foods that are closer to nature, what I mean is less processed, that's better for your health. It's going to benefit you in so many ways as you get older.
Jessica, thanks a lot for your time. Really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Fred.
Jessica Stafford is a registered dietitian with SSM Health, St. Joseph Hospital, Lake St. Louis. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If you want to hear parts of this show again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.